Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hey, 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 and welcome to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the show that brings you the best of the best feminist content. I'm your host, Neba from Notes by Neba, and today I am also joined by another amazing host, Emma.
Hey, yay, Neba, thank you for having me. As Neba said, I'm Emma, pronouns she, her, hers, and I am so stoked to be here. We have a really great segment coming up, and I know Neba and I have had some really good conversation before this, so let's get into it. Neba, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to be talking about what you don't know you already know about America. Basically, if you are a person who has lived here, you're here your whole life, or you're a person who was born into a family that was here their whole life, there are certain things that you might know about America just intrinsically. And these are kind of just like silent, quiet things. And so really, this is just kind of a jumping off platform for us to talk about immigration, Asian Americans. This episode comes with a trigger warning of racism and discrimination as well.
Yeah. And, you know, as y'all know who are listening, if you've heard some of my segments before, I'm a public historian. So, you know, I'm going to bring in a little bit of history. I'll try not to keep it too dry. Neba, you can keep me on track here. and, you know, just a disclaimer too, is like, I am Japanese American, I'm Asian American, but we are not a monolith. And what we're talking about, our experiences are not representative of all of the past histories. This is not a comprehensive episode. You know, I think we could probably talk for hours and hours and hours. So just putting that out there first.
Yeah, of course. You know, all of these episodes really, you know, always when you're looking at some media, make sure you look at who's actually saying it. You know, the other day I came across a great piece of work in a book, and I was like, huh, it just made me go, is this author a person of color? And I had to Google it. Every once in a while, you just come across some media that you're just like, who wrote this? And, you know, that's definitely the case here. I'm a queer first generation woman of color myself. I am Indian American. Some people classify that as Asian American because that's how America likes to classify this. This episode will also be mostly about America because we'll get into like the law, the history of how it all started. And with that, let's get into it, actually. A very quick and attempting to be brief history of the just anti-Asian racism in the US and exclusion. We're going to start with the 1790s and get right on up to now. So starting with like 1790 to about like 1952, we had the Naturalization Act, which kind of gave for citizenship to free white persons. But, you know, shortly after that, there was a lot of what's quote unquote yellow peril. The idea of being scared of people from Asia, the idea that people from Asia had yellow skin, that they were something to be worried about. And I think it's really weirdly apt. So history definitely has a way of repeating itself because we're almost having another round of yellow peril right now. This was seen in a lot of ways. For example, the Page Act of 1875, Chinese women were not allowed to come into the US. And overall, there was just a lot of laws that made life and immigration really difficult. From 1882 to 1973, Chinese people were just altogether excluded from being able to come into America. And this act was actually extended with another act, which I also think is just kind of an interesting way of looking at laws. You know, if a law is passed once and then extended, it just really shows how permeated that belief has become, as opposed to just aging out of time. As time went on, we kind of almost had a little bit of progress. In about 1907 and 1908, we had the Gentlemen's Agreement. It was that between the US and Japan that the US would not have any restrictions on Japanese immigration, but Japanese would not allow further emigration to the US. So kind of a weird dichotomy there. We've also had laws governing who gets to own land. This is seen not just with Asian American populations, but this happened as a way of kind of keeping control and power and wealth out of Black Americans as well. So with the 1913 and 1920 California alien land laws, Asian immigrants were not allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to lease land for more than 3 years in a row. They weren't allowed to hold land for children who are citizens. And land ownership is a really, really big way that people hold generational wealth and can pass on generational wealth. You know, if you're renting a location as opposed to like living in a house, renting is really, in financial terms, you're just flushing money down the toilet. You're not getting any return on that. You're getting to live for cheap, but it's not like you're putting that money towards the house or like paying off a mortgage or anything like that. And then, Emma, why don't you go ahead and tell us about some of these Supreme Court decisions that happened as well?
Yeah. And Neva, that was a great sum up of, I mean, there's so much history here. And keep in mind, we're just hitting some really big ones. But as Neva said, like yellow peril was kind of a thread throughout this whole time. And it's a lot of similar rhetoric that we hear now is like this fear that Asian immigrants were going to steal jobs, this fear that Asian men would steal away white women. And it kind of ties in with Neva, what you were mentioning about the Naturalization Act, because at that time, naturalized citizenship was really only to free white persons until the 14th Amendment. But even then, Asian immigrants were classified as non-white by the court systems. So they did not count as free white persons, meaning that they could not have that naturalized citizenship. And obviously all of the rights and the good things about having an American citizenship, they could not have. And I just want to mention, I'm not going to get into like court cases too deeply here, but like a couple that you may have heard of. And if you haven't, I definitely encourage y'all to just kind of do a little bit of research or reach out to me. But for example, Ozawa versus the United States in 1922, that was a Supreme Court case where a Japanese immigrant, Ozawa, argued that he should be able to be a citizen because he said that his skin color was white. And I'm not going to get too deeply into this, but I definitely could of all the things behind that. We'll get into some, I think, some colorism conversation in a little bit. But the Supreme Court said no, and that white was synonymous with Caucasian. And because he was Japanese, that he couldn't count as white. He couldn't be a naturalized citizen. And we also see this later with this case in 1927 called Gom Lung versus Rice, which was actually in Mississippi. And a lot of my background, like knowledge and history, is American history and Asian American history in the South. So specifically like Virginia, and here we're talking about Mississippi. And here there were actually large populations of Chinese immigrants in Mississippi. And at the time, the Supreme Court case formally established this quote unquote colored status of the Chinese. So they were counted as non-white by the Supreme Court, and they could not go to schools reserved for whites. And as we know, this was a time of segregation. So there's just some really interesting pieces here. And on top of that, like this is around the same time we've got this act called the National Origins Act, which severely restricted immigration, and it put national quota systems on immigrants coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, but it essentially excluded Asians. I think, if I remember correctly, there were quotas from Asian countries that only allowed 100 Asian immigrants in for the year or something. And this was a policy that stayed in effect until the 1960s. So if you ever for fun decide to look through the census, you will see much, much less Asian immigrants in this time. I'm just going to mention really quickly before Neva, I hand it right back off to you. But, you know, and then not too long after the National Origins Act, 1942, there's Japanese American and Japanese incarceration during World War II, which I think a lot of us do hear about, but maybe not in depth. And that also affected Japanese Latin Americans as well as Japanese Canadians. And they were sent to the camps here in the United States. And that's a piece that I think gets left out a lot. And not only that, but when Japanese Americans who were citizens, only citizens, were given reparations. When reparations were given, the Japanese Latin Americans and Japanese Canadians were left out of those reparations.
I also want to point out, you know, as much as people like to be like, oh, reparations kind of solve the problem, they really don't. You never really can, like, you know, give back someone's, you know, years away from being in their house, or, you know, the trauma that you inflict upon them by being in these camps. Like, and the reparations, I think, for each citizen was like $20,000, which you know, at that time was a sizable chunk of money, but also, you know, being in a camp for like, you know, 4 or 5 years, that's also, I don't know if I would do that for any amount of money, you know? Yeah, it doesn't even begin to touch on actually solving the problem. And, you know, shortly after this incarceration, we had the Vietnam War from 1955 to 1975. This created a lot of kind of like anti-Asian ideology. You know, Vietnam, a lot of people fought alongside U.S. soldiers. But, you know, when people came back, they had a lot of quote unquote mail order brides. A lot of women were really treated as kind of just sex objects. Around this time, also, the term Asian American got coined, becoming this weird, like, blanket term to just describe all of Asia, which, you know, is so wild to me. You could point to, like, Europe and be like, oh, actually, this, like, tiny part of Portugal right here versus, like, Eastern Germany. And, like, with Asia, it's just like, oh, here's China. And that's, yeah, like, you know, the size of freaking Europe, which is a whole just bad way of classifying things. But anyway, moving on from that,
I will say though, Neba, like for the term Asian American, it's so interesting because when it came out in the 60s and 70s, like it did not have the same meaning as it does now. It was a very radical anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, like really like extreme term in some ways. And then essentially we see it really co-opted by those in power and government now, which is now we see it the way we see it. But it was at the time, for a very brief moment there, very radical.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that. It's interesting the way that like language has kind of evolved to, you know, go around these various social justice meanings and stuff like that. You know, a really great example is like the word queer and, you know, kind of co-opting that as well. So I guess getting into one of the things I find really fascinating, because it's very pertinent to people of this generation alive now, is the 1965 Immigration Act. This was basically a law that kind of like removed the discrimination against Southern Eastern Europeans and Asians and a lot of like non-European ethnic groups. The primary way that it kind of ended up affecting a lot of immigrants is that it created this kind of like preference system. So it gave a lot of priority to people's relatives, people's children. So if you were a citizen and you were trying to get like your wife here, or if you're trying to get your kids or your parents or something like that, they would now have priority. But on top of that, and this is where a lot of the model minority myth kind of comes in here, is that it also gave priority to professionals, individuals with specialized skills. So doctors, engineers, people who with a high level of training, scientists, you know, not lawyers exactly because you can't practice here, but it kind of like created this provision that selected for really highly trained and very generally wealthy immigrants to come. And so now we have a lot of model minority myths surrounding Asian Americans, this idea that like, oh, you're all doctors, engineers, businessmen, et cetera. A lot of that comes from this act that like selectively chose those kinds of people to be able to immigrate. But it also, you know, Asians and many other different immigrants have been immigrating from before that, after that. Many people have immigrated without these kinds of skills. And so when you see things saying like, you know, oh, Asians don't deserve some sort of item because they are all smart, you know, that's not quite true. But that's kind of this act is actually the origin of like where all of these like model myths came from. And so that 1965 act was what allowed a lot of people to come in from like 1965 to literally now. It's still in effect. And so as more and more and more children and relatives came in, as more professionals and highly trained people came in, it kind of created this culture around what sort of jobs Asians did, what sort of people they were, what kind of things they knew. And we see this especially with me. I live in California, and we see a lot of kind of divide between people who came in under the priority for specialized skills versus the people who came in for priority through some sort of other way. So that kind of still affects us now, but this all kind of came to a bit more of a flaring head in 1982 with the murder of Vincent Chin. Emma, I know you have a lot of history on this, and that there's so much to say about it. Can you try and summarize it a little bit for us?
Yeah, where to start? Vincent Chin was brutally murdered in Detroit by two white men who mistook him for Japanese American And they essentially, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, this fear that Asian Americans were stealing jobs. And at the time, it was a very tense atmosphere in Detroit. And it was just a really nasty, nasty murder. And actually, the story is really sad if you don't know too much about it. Vincent Chen did die, and his mom went around to different places to try and get justice for him. And I mean, it was a very traumatic, I think, experience for her as well. And she did end up moving back to Asia. And she was obviously like upset with, I mean, who wouldn't be, the lack of justice there. But really, like, the murder of Vincent Chen, it was a really historical kind of monumental event, because I think it really reawoken. And I say reawoken because I think Asian American and Asian America in some ways was very much radically awoken in the 60s and 70s. But with the murder of Vincent Chin, it really reawoke this movement of Asian Americans recognizing this history that we just went through, this history of exclusion, this history of racism. And it's just, I definitely like encourage y'all to kind of do a little bit more research on this, because it's a really important story that I think a lot of us don't learn the full details of.
Yeah, and we have like a weird history repeats itself moment here too, where, you know, the murder of someone who's a person of color by white people has triggered kind of this huge, there were so many protests, there were all kinds of things that happened as a result of it. UC Berkeley developed the first Asian American curriculum as a result of the protests that happened around Vincent Chin's murder. There was a lot of academic support, there were a lot of support from non-Asian Americans as well. And, you know, last year with yet more murders of the Black community, we saw a very similar thing happening where it took the literal murder of human lives in order for people to decide, oh, hey, maybe this is a little important here. And yet, you know, it is something that, you know, similarly, it was reawoken. These are issues that have been going on, yet for some reason, you know, having just like this catalyst really kind of like pushed things over the edge. A similar thing happened with 9/11 when, you know, people of a certain group decided to commit a really horrible terrorist act. And this ultimately but just resulted in not just the discrimination of South Asians and Muslim Americans and Arab Americans, but also the loss of thousands and thousands of civilian lives in those Middle East, South Asian countries. We're going to keep this episode focused on immigration. I'm not going to touch the amount of things that have happened over there. But, you know, now it's interesting. We went through kind of a phase of, you know, Hollywood portraying the villain as, you know, always wearing a turban and having a big black beard. And it's interesting to kind of see the way that media portrays villains and who is the villain, because it's always a really great reflection of where society is in that moment as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it makes me think of too, like, as we talk about this, I always try to mention the Claire Jean Kim, who's a sociologist, the racial triangulation theory. There's a really great article, I'll link it in the show notes, but essentially, like, what it really shows is this idea that, like, the showing the past and showing how the treatment of non-Black, non-white people really show the flexibility and resourcefulness of white supremacy and the systems in place. And not just that, but the racial triangulation theory is that, like, Asian Americans, and this was something I learned even in my research, is like, we're not like in the middle between Black Americans and white Americans. Like, the racial triangulation theory is showing us and telling us that, you know, we are all participants or involved in white supremacy, and that this racism is institutional from the top down. Hopefully that kind of makes sense. If not, we can figure
this out. Yeah, you know, it's kind of this idea of, you know, it's not whites versus Blacks. It's not whites and Asians versus Blacks. It's not Blacks and Asians versus whites. It's this concept of, like, each ethnic group exists in its own way. And in a lot of ways, Asian Americans have been anti-Black, and in a lot of ways they've been allies to Black people. But similarly, they've also been people who've supported a lot of white supremacy. We see a lot of, I took a very interesting class at UC Davis that touched on the idea of dating and interracial marriage and like what is quote unquote acceptable to marry into and what's not. And there's a very huge and pervasive idea amongst a lot of ethnic groups that dating a white person is somehow seen as moving up in the social ladder and climbing your way to the top. But yet marrying someone who's perhaps quote unquote lower in the social caste might be something that is not as favored upon. And so, you know, in these ways, we kind of still do continue to uphold these ideas of white supremacy. And I think racial triangulation theory, you know, it puts us as a triangle, but really there's so many ethnic groups. It's a better, I don't know, maybe it's a racial polygonal theory. a better way of looking at that. But
yeah,
I think really it's just the concept of like recognizing that you just can't be lumped in with white people, black people. And when immigrants come in, there's this interesting concept of kind of like, how does a person look at an immigrant versus a first generation person or a second generation person? Oftentimes you don't know that they're first generation or second generation when you just look at them. And yet at the same time, people who have been born here and raised here feel very different and may act very different from the people who have just immigrated from here. And we're going to touch a bit on kind of like, what does it really mean to be born in America versus not? Like, how much do you lose your identity? Do you have a new identity, et cetera? But before that, a little bit of positivity to balance out all of this stuff. Some societies that have helped in all of this nonsense. Emma, you know a lot about mutual aid societies. You chatted about them earlier when we were talking. Can you take us away?
Sure. Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought in like the positivity and the I'm a firm believer in mutual aid and community care. And I think especially as we talk about these really traumatic pieces of history for Asian America, like there were a lot of mutual aid societies that supported each other, and not just Asian American, but a lot of early immigrant populations around the 17th and 18th century. Usually this was for newly immigrated groups, but I'm going to talk a little bit in a second about another situation that I think is really important. But mutual assistance and self-help have been cornerstones of the Black community for generations. W.E. Du Bois said the first wavering step of a people towards organized social life. So one of the things that too, like as we think of mutual aid societies historically, as well as mutual aid societies now, is the importance of how focused it is on community. So those of you who aren't familiar with mutual aid, it's not charity. Like very specifically is not charity. It addresses immediate concerns with whoever in the community needs it. And the difference is when we think about charity is there's so many eligibility requirements very often. And charity's increasingly privatized. It's contracted out to the nonprofit sector. I'm not going to get into the nonprofit industrial complex, but definitely something to look up and explore on your own. But again, like same with a lot of pieces for the government, right? When people need money, there's so many eligibility requirements. And sometimes people and community needs resources and money or access to resources immediately, right? We see this during COVID. And I do want to throw out, there's a really, really good book called Mutual Aid by Dean Spade. It's really short. And I think if you're interested remotely at all in learning more about contemporary mutual aid or just trying to understand the strategies around it, check that one out. And you know, like a good example historically of mutual aid is like, I think of the Japanese Mutual Aid Society in Chicago. So after World War II, during the time the incarceration camps were out, as some Japanese Americans were getting out of the camps, you know, imagine if you were in a camp and you don't really have anything anymore. Like some people, if their homes are gone, if they didn't have like white allies to watch their businesses or their homes or their things. And so the Japanese Mutual Aid Society in Chicago, for example, would help set up people leaving the camps. They would help them get an apartment, a home. They would help them get a job. And basically, like this sense of community was really needed, especially as Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans were obviously very highly prejudiced against. There's small numbers of them in a kind of isolated area in Chicago. And so, you know, these mutual aid societies offered a sense of belonging, but also offered resources. So I think that kind of leads to this kind of conversation around community care, right? And individualism in American culture. Neva, did you want to mention anything about our culture of individualism?
Oh boy. You know, a lot of like ideologies get split up into like Western versus Eastern, and we're going to be making a lot of huge generalities here, largely focusing on the Northern Hemisphere, but really it's just that like the US and a lot of quote unquote like Western ideologies are very individualistic, but in the US specifically, individualism has been just this core of the entire American dream. Really just mix a little bit of like New England people being super pure and Christian, and mix in the philosophy of like what rights you have, and mix in the concept of like, I'm gonna go strike off to America and live the American dream. And you get people thinking that, you know, their whole life just revolves around themselves, not as community focused. A little, it has its pros and cons, you know, just like any other ideology. The pros being, you know, that you can try and like shape your own destiny. The cons being that like maybe you don't care about certain members of your community. But, you know, we saw a lot of like this kind of ideology coming out in COVID. You know, we saw a lot of communities that cared for each other, that were perhaps more Asian Americans lived in, there was higher rates of, you know, wearing masks and mask compliance and thinking about, you know, I need to do this for the good of my community, not just for myself. A lot of like anti-maskers, a lot of people who don't quote unquote believe in COVID-19 have this ideology of like, well, you can choose to wear a mask, but I'm going to choose not to, and not realizing that, you know, that action affects other people. And so this idea of just being really individualistic, it doesn't just segregate based on race. It also segregates based on where you're located. For example, people who live in more densely populated areas like cities tend to think more long-term. They tend to think more about communities because they're just in closer contact with a lot of other people. Even if you're a person who's like very introverted and you live in a huge city, you still are just seeing so many people. You're still, as you walk down the street, being exposed to lots of graffiti or art or street art or just in like restaurants and stuff. Your brain is taking in all these things, whether or not you personally are realizing all of this. An example I really like thinking about is the idea of where do elderly people in the community kind of live? In America, a lot of adults would prefer to stay in their current house for as long as they can, but it's not often very possible. Most people don't even think it's going to be possible, but really, you know, it requires a significant amount of wealth that not a lot of people have. It requires the ability to, as you get significantly older, be able to have family that has the free time and the resources to care for you and make sure your needs are met, or to hire a person to be able to do that for you. Versus in, there's a lot of cultural differences. About 42% of Asian Pacific Islanders, for example, will provide care to their older adults compared to only 22% of the general population. That's like a twofold increase with Asian Pacific Islander populations compared to just general people. You know, the system of taking care of aging people is really broken. COVID-19 has really worsened this. You have to either be wealthy enough to pay for it. You got to either like deplete your income and your assets enough that you qualify for Medicaid, or you have to have people in your life that are free enough to be able to care for you in this way. I think, you know, when we look at COVID too, there's been a lot of instances of, you know, people living in homes and not being able to see their families because they're, you know, needing to do that for safety. In a lot of Asian cultures, the idea was to kind of like have this big house that many generations would live in. You would have the grandparents living in the house and the parents living in the house, and the grandparents would be able to take care of the grandkid in the house because they were all living under the same roof. And it wasn't seen as this like, oh, everyone needs to live in a separate place. And this is especially seen in like America, because in Europe, it's not as big of a deal to be a kid or a child or a young adult and be living in the same house as your parents. It's quite common for people to live in the same house as their parents up until they're married, or even just right before they get married. And it's in the US that there seems to be this association of shame and guilt with it. I'm sure there's, you know, a motley of reasons as to why, but thinking about kind of like the ways that community takes care of each other and segregates is a really clear indication of like how that society is going. For example, where people choose to live, you know, as immigrants move to America, where they choose to live will really affect their experience and also affect the things that they learn or maybe do not learn about America. So these places are all known as ethnic enclaves if there are a lot of people from a specific ethnicity in there. Emma, you mentioned your dad and community was part of this.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of pieces that you're talking about that really resonate with me and Neva, because I actually just moved my grandparents are Japanese. So my grandfather immigrated here from Japan and my grandmother was born in the United States, but spent almost her entire life in Japan until she was older. So like, I'm thinking a lot about what you're talking about as far as the putting the elderly in homes, because I actually just moved my grandparents from independent living in Little Tokyo, which is a ethnic enclave in downtown LA. And they have always wanted to be around other Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans, around Japanese shops, other people who speak Japanese. And because of that, we made the decision to, I live in Virginia, so there are definitely no Little Tokyos or Nihon Machis here in Virginia, or really even on the East Coast, even New York City. And so we made the decision to move my grandparents to a senior care home called Nikkei Senior Gardens, which is very specifically for Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants. And it made me think of when you were talking to Neva earlier about the cultural differences, is even the pieces about having immigrant relatives that don't speak English well. So like if you put your, if you, you help move your grandparents into a care facility, if that care facility doesn't speak that language, then how, like, what's communicated, right? So like we made that decision because my grandparents almost fully speak Japanese now. They don't really speak English. So if there are doctors, like in this place, there are doctors who speak Japanese, there are care aides who speak Japanese. But, you know, if they're around people that only spoke English, how would they know what's wrong with them? So like, I think that's another whole other piece of it. And not just that, but going back a little bit to the ethnic enclaves is like this piece that, you know, it can be really, really lonely to not have some of these historical places. For example, Chinatowns formed due to anti-Asian racism in the 1870s. There was even a small Chinese community in the early 1900s here in Virginia, in Richmond. And honestly, like, there obviously, like, segregation most frequently serves dominant groups who use isolation to disproportionately apportion resources and exploit marginalized workers. But a number of opportunities can also lead to strong social and cultural networks within ethnic enclaves.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of like similar ethnic enclaves all around SF in the Bay Area. And it's really interesting seeing, like, you know, a lot of these places, it's just expected that you speak the language that the people in the care home should take care of. But that's a huge privilege that people not in like cities and densely populated areas may have, especially if you choose to not live in an ethnic enclave. For example, you get to have a lot of perks of like learning more about the culture much sooner. For example, you may have a neighbor who can help you with your FAFSA, or might be able to connect you for a job, or, you know, teach you how to drive as you get your driver's license. But really, like, you know, going back to this concept of speaking the English language, you know, everyone loves to like make fun of people for accents, but I always think of the fact that like people who speak with accents, that just means they're smart enough to know multiple languages. But English is by far the world's most studied language because, well, it's just one, it's super privileged, but two, it's just like a language that is considered an essential to success. It's a stepping stone for opportunities, which is really just a means of like, hey, Britain low-key colonized the whole world. The sun never sat on the British Empire. And so it's just a language that's taught in many, many countries, and it became like a huge unifying force. But you know, if you do know English, you it's much easier for you to like have access to institutions, whether they be social, political, educational. You have this extra form of capital. You your speech is now perceived a little more positively. People kind of like often look more positively on people who are able to speak with English, especially without an accent. And if you are, say, within America, it kind of feeds into a lot of like standards of like, you know, you have to be able to speak English. And there's that like classic anti-racist remark of like, we're in America, in this country, we speak English. But, you know, just because you speak a different language doesn't mean you're not proficient in English. And just because you're not proficient in English doesn't make you any less of a human being. I always like to think that like, oh, hey, you know, like I said earlier, it just means you're smart enough to know multiple languages. And like, when you look at a lot of American populations, they only know how to speak English. And even then, they don't really know how to speak it that well. So that's kind of like bringing us up to where we are now. And which brings us really into like the meat of all of this, of what you don't realize you know about America. For example, one really big one is the idea of being able to visit your family. A lot of holidays in America, and I say holidays specifically because, you know, those are the days that are you get off from work. Those are the days that like are reserved to be able to often be able to go visit family. You can't just go and like pop home real quick for Thanksgiving if your family lives 3,000 miles away. But there's also a lot of fears of, you know, you want to visit your family, but there's also a fear of going back there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think especially like, hopefully you guys can see too, even when we're talking about the history, is that fear is not unfounded historically in the United States. People have been sent back and people continue to be sent back. In 2018, 47.9% of all Latinx U.S. citizens reported deportation fears, which is up 41% in 2007. And just to keep in mind too, like how new ICE is, there's a whole other piece of history here with the history of ICE and the history of deportation, the history of borders. But, you know, ICE is still pretty new. And we see even now, like families of members who are undocumented often live in the shadows. We're seeing that even right now with Haitian immigrants and refugees seeking asylum. And, you know, Biden is still putting money into ICE, unfortunately. So definitely something to kind of be aware of.
Yeah, it's just a, I don't know, it's you pick the least poison. Ultimately, you know, if you're an immigrant, you just don't quite belong. You may be running away from something terrible, but you may also be running towards something better. But regardless of which of those groups you are a part of, there's still this like inherent feeling of like not belonging, which is so ironic when you consider that, like, you know, America was a land of people of color that just got genocided into oblivion. And I saw a very interesting TikTok the other day. That was disgusting. I was on conservative TikTok because sometimes I like to play with fire. And this person was saying, oh, you know, if we let people wear masks, what's next? Are we going to let America get colonized? And I was like, oh, buddy, there's mental gymnastics to be happening here. Oh my God. It is just wild. It is just wild. But the way that you can like not belong ranges, you know, for example, knowing what to even say during an interview, there's a lot of like soft skills, how to write an email. There's a lot of soft skills that no one ever bothers like explicitly teaching students. The ways that you like apply for a credit card, or the reason that you might want to like bounce between credit cards, or the reason that you might want to bounce between jobs a little bit right after you graduate from college, why that actually would really help your income and help you like, you know, make an extra 15K if you do that. But these are all like little silent soft things that no one really tells you about unless you have been a part of the system. And if you've been a part of that privileged system, even little things like going to the bathroom. Americans don't often use bidets, even though they've had like a weird resurgence and like popularity.
It's so sad,
during
you guys are missing out.
Pandemic.
You're missing out.
Well, it's been getting popular. Yes. I think it's gotten like a little popular during the plague. Which like it's nice that it's gotten a little more popular, but in a lot of countries, people squat to use the bathroom, and that is like not necessarily what we do here. Which is so weird. Like squatting is actually better for you pooping. If you ever want to find a reason to squat and poop, you can look up the better pooper, like a little thing
squatty
that you
potty.
Put underneath your toilet to lift up your legs. Yeah, the squatty potty. It just helps get your poop out a little bit better. And you know, there's actual like biological reasons that you might want to squat to poop. It's not just like oh, this doesn't look as good or whatever. But having all these like, you know, feelings of not belonging and and like it just it adds a lot of pressure to people who have moved here to try and be as successful as possible. And for people who are moving for a better life, their pressure often ends up being on the children. This concept of like, we sacrificed everything for you, so you have to succeed. According to the New York Times, this is a fun statistic I found, about 60% of the growth in university employment since the year 2000 has come from US-born children of immigrants or immigrant students. A huge part of this is that immigrant students have to pay a lot more for this education. And so oftentimes when universities are trying to make bank, you just enroll more immigrant students because they pay so much more tuition compared to the students who are nearby. But, you know, there's a lot of pressures of who is insured, who is uninsured, who has to translate for their parents when they go and, you know, conduct business even, or talk to bankers, who's going to be the translator in these situations. These pressures of caring for people really lead to like a lot of mental health problems in these conditions. And because of a lot of the stigma around mental health, which we'll get into in a second, many are afraid to seek medical care.
Yeah, Neva, I love that you mentioned we sacrificed everything for you, so you have to succeed, because like I feel like my dad got a lot of that, a lot more than I did, although I did get it from my grandparents to make sure I got my college degree and got a good job, quote unquote. But it's interesting shifting that to mental health, because my dad actually became a psychologist. So he has his PhD, and my grandparents always say to him, like, well, you're not a real doctor. Which, you know, I think that speaks a lot to the way that a lot of, and this is changing. And again, like, I cannot speak for everyone here, but how a lot of Asian Americans view and Asian immigrants view mental health, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it obviously affects a lot of financial issues, but really it's just like the stigma of mental health in these communities. So a lot of these communities do not look positively upon seeking help for mental health struggles. It's seen as being weak or that you're just not good enough. About 10 to 15% of kids who are in immigrant families have some symptoms of depression. That's about 4 million children, probably. And it's just the children of like people of color, especially like Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, Latinx immigrants. These children have much like really significantly higher rates of depression and anxiety and PTSD compared to the children of white European immigrants. This is because of, you know, all those barriers that we described earlier, language difficulties, isolation, having to apply for college without anyone to walk you through it, having to navigate college without knowing anyone who's ever been there, without having, you know, oh, I don't have, you know, a person who's been a part of a sorority. I can't just be a legacy student at this other school. I don't know what to do for the SAT. Who do I prepare for? What is nutrition? What is healthy? Where do I go if I want to do this specific activity? What is the safe way? What is the correct way? And throughout all of that, having to perform at like 150% compared to, you know, your white counterparts, just to be given, you know, a raise that is less than them at work.
Yeah, it really speaks to like imposter syndrome too. Like, I remember reading an article last year saying like specifically women of color, especially Black women and LGBTQ people, have much higher feelings of imposter syndrome. And like, it goes along with that sense of belonging, right? It's like, and not only that, honestly, but like me speaking as a Japanese American in Virginia, like that sense of belonging is so like that sense of imposter syndrome. I'm in primarily white spaces, or like mostly white spaces for work all of the time. And like, I see that slowly changing, but like, there are so many spaces where there are not people of color, there are not Black people, there are not Indigenous people that should be in those rooms. And so like, I think it really speaks to all of those pieces you're talking about with the mental health, with significantly higher rates of anxiety, depression, imposter syndrome, all of that heavy stuff.
Well, we're getting a little salty here. Maybe it's time to like bring it back to something that's a little more happy again. So thinking about that, you know, ways that we can heal, ways that we can help, ultimately, I think healing as a community will be a really big part of it. For those of you who are listening and are children of immigrants or descendants of immigrants, finding things that make your life more whole rather than only the things that have been defined as success by society, that be money, work, a straight marriage, these kinds of success things are not the only ways of success. Sometimes success is planting a tomato and harvesting 10 tomatoes from your tomato. I think that's pretty neat. That's a small example, but you know, also just finding people who love you, finding your community, really just living a life that's happy. Because oftentimes, you know, it's so easy to get into this concept of like, oh, being this hardworking, overachieving person that's constantly working. And as a result of working so much at work, you get given more tasks, and then you don't want to disappoint anyone because that's how you've been raised. So you decide to do those. And so in response to doing those and doing them well, you get even more. And then at that point, maybe you get like a promotion or something, but this is just such a recipe for burnout, this concept of like working so hard for not very much. You know, as much as work can bring you a lot of joy, it is still work, and you have to have a variety of things in your life. The last thing you want to do is like, you know, look back on your life and be like, you're not going to be like, oh man, I wish I had finished that spreadsheet. You're going to be like, oh, I wish I had taken a trip to, I don't know, to see the big blue hole or something like that. And in terms of our allies, Emma, how can allies?
Yeah, help? I just want to add on too. I think it's so important what you're saying, Neva, because like, I think in a capitalist society, it's really easy to get our identity caught up with our jobs. But at the end of the day, like, we are so much more than that. So like separating that identity and adding on to like how allies can help. And I think back on when we were talking about with mutual aid, right? Is like community care. And like, I really recommend to you all, like getting to know the community and the space that you're occupying. Like, where are you? Like, who are the, like Neva said, like, who are the people around you, and getting to know that in a really meaningful way. And I think that really leads to like how allies can help too, is like, I think all of those pieces are really important, is like getting to know people. Also like cross-cultural solidarity. The Cross-Cultural Solidarity History Project highlights allyship in history. And we'll put in the show notes a few additional resources as well. And, you know, I'm a huge proponent of mutual aid. And, you know, a lot of your cities and towns, like, they might have their own mutual aid fund. And I highly recommend, if you are able to, if you have the money, you know, just put in like a standing like $5, $10 a month into that mutual aid, because it will go into community resources and helping your neighbors. All that to say is that I could talk to you guys for hours and hours and hours about history, and I don't think you'd want to listen for hours and hours and hours about history, but I will put a few like blogs that I've written for institutions, and you know, feel free to DM me. Like, I'd love to continue this conversation with those of you listening. You know, if you have questions about history things, like, feel free to throw them to me. And you know, my Instagram handle is @bookedwithemma, and I'd love to keep exploring this. And Neva, thank you so much for having me. I mean, I really appreciate the conversation. And I, like I said, I'm pretty sure we could probably talk for hours about this. So I appreciate you helping me keep time here.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.